then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, a vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I've heard orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be, in the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more bore for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, put your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night. Many a manly chest was throbbing for the blessed warming light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the banshee's lonely crew, and the thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest Homeland, comrades. It's August the 13th, 2015. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. I'd like to begin this week with a reminder that Friday, August 14th, is the last day to order any of my Northwest novels online from the previous publishers before the publication ban on my fiction, all of it, not just the political works, goes into effect. I believe that if you scour the internet, you will probably be able to find a few copies here and there from smaller vendors and other alternate sources for a few months, after which the supply of old pre-2015 copies are going to dry up. I do not as yet know precisely what the deal will be with availability on Kindle, because Amazon.com is a separate company from the three publishers who banned my print books. If Amazon is in cahoots with the previous publishers on banning my work, then it could well be that everything, every reference to my fiction, all the customer reviews, etc., will simply disappear from the Amazon site on the morning of August 15th, or in the weeks immediately following, depending on how efficient the ban really is. I do not know if Amazon is contractually bound to remove my books from their Kindle cloud or servers or whatever if the issuing publisher cancels them. I guess we'll see about that next Saturday. I would like to say yet again that if you read my books on Kindle, you need to purchase and download them onto your device before Friday, not keep them in the cloud, which in techie gibberish means on the Amazon servers, because my books will almost certainly disappear from there. I repeat yet again that steps are being taken to ensure the continued availability of my work, especially the Northwest novels, but although I will make occasional references to those steps from now on in this podcast, I am going to play the details very close to the vest because, as I've stated before, and as I can't emphasize sufficiently, thanks to all the publicity generated by the night of the Charleston Vespers 2 months ago, we are now being placed under the microscope by some pretty vile and malevolent people who will use any information they pick up about the NF here in some attempt to do harm. You can keep up with what's going on via the Northwest Revolution email list, and if you go so far as to join the party and actually comply with the little formality of paying your dues, you can receive the organizational letter, which will contain more details. Now, on a related subject about the podcast and its contents, what can go on and what cannot. As you guys may remember, a couple of months ago, when we underwent our relatively minor media feeding frenzy, I noted that Radio Free Northwest was being listened to and its contents distorted, quoted out of context, and used against us by the more reptilian lefty libs in an attempt to do harm. We have to assume that some of these scum have acquired the habit now, and that we're being monitored not just by secret police and NGO spies who will do little except write up reports and summaries for their superiors in order to earn their paychecks, but who will actively attempt to appropriate the contents of RFN and misuse those contents, seriously to try and hurt people whom they hate, me or white people in general. And this means I have to start exercising a lot more discretion about what goes on the air here. Now, the first thing I banned was quote-unquote crazy talk, which I generally define as unsubstantiated conspiracy theory or anything which could make us sound crazy to the muggles, no matter how legitimate the topic might be. Okay, now, there is a good deal of legitimate room for discussion here as to exactly what constitutes excessive or unreasonable conspiracy theory, I got a little bit of flack for letting Lord Lucan on last week, but as I said at the time, he actually brought in some documentation about that thing with the dead doctors. Now, you have to bear in mind that this is America in 2015, and our audience are white Americans who have been brought up to accept spin rather than substance. Many of them honestly can no longer quite tell the difference between what seems on TV or the internet and what is in the real world. White Americans' grasp on reality is becoming more and more tenuous as young white boys retreat into a fantasy game World of Warcraft, and young white girls retreat into sexual fantasies about being carried off by emo vampires, Justin Bieber with teeth or whatever. No, really, the line between what is real and what is left-wing politically correct spin is becoming very blurred in a lot of people's minds, and as we found out 2 months ago, huge numbers of people are simply going to believe whatever their favorite lefty-lib blogger tells them about the Northwest Front. That's why, in addition to banning crazy talk on here and in the comments section on Thought Crime and Homeland, I've also had to ban gun talk. This week, I received a 6 or 7 minute audio file from a young comrade in the homeland, which contained some comments on his favorite firearms and why they were his favorites, something that would have been considered completely innocent and innocuous even as recently as 30 years ago. The kind of thing fathers used to teach their sons about firearms, and in some parts of this country still do. But I listened to that audio file, and I thought about it a while, and I reached the conclusion that I simply can't take the risk of having any gun-specific content on here. Now think about that. Firearms are like tobacco in this country, a legal product which can be bought, sold, and owned lawfully, but if you do much else with them, all of a sudden bad things start happening because the politically correct ideology and the dictatorship it serves doesn't want white people owning or using either. Like freedom of speech, white boys have that right, it's just that the government doesn't want you to exercise it. En passant, have you ever noticed how anti-smoking campaigns never seem to target blacks or Hispanics? Now, if you want to know why I made this decision, I refer you to the screaming hysteria of 2 months ago on the part of the lefty libs over the night of the Charleston Vespers. You have to be a connoisseur of their horse shit like I've become down through the years, truly to appreciate what was happening then. This wasn't just the usual shrill and screeching hatred these scum on Salon and Hufflepuff howl at Republicans or Rush Limbaugh or white boys in general on a regular basis. This was something different. This reaction was fear on their part. Hell, it was stark terror on their part. The one thing the lefty libs have always trembled in fear of most is that some of those 300 million privately owned firearms in this country are going to start coming out of the gun cabinets and the closets aimed at them. One of the stupid headlines on their website at the time, like the one calling me a shadowy white supremacist guru or whatever, stated that I quote-unquote promised more massacres. Now, of course, I did no such thing. But I did and do predict, not promise, that there are going to be more Dylann Roof-style incidents if these lefty-lib morons and their Democratic Party don't stop abusing and insulting and robbing and degrading and vilifying white people. There's no conspiracy here. It's a simple fact of human nature. People will only put up with just so much of the kind of mistreatment that white people are receiving at the hands of this government and the Salinistas who support it. But while we wait for all this to play out, and it will play out, I can't risk having any talk about guns on this show, especially any talk about guns from a young white man, no matter how innocuous the discussion may be, because the extreme likelihood that such a young man's words will be overheard by hostiles, seized on, distorted out of all recognition, selectively quoted light years out of context and used in an attempt to do harm to human beings who are hated by the Salon and Hufflepuff crowd for daring to have the wrong color skin and daring to think for themselves, well, that risk is just too great. It's not even a risk, it's a likelihood. Now, you have to bear in mind, these Guardian and Politico.com people are not journalists. They are stenographers for the ruling power elite, and their purpose is not to report the news or inform anyone of anything, but to shape thought and socially engineer belief systems to the order of that power elite. It is entirely conceivable that the mere presence of a young white male on this show speaking on the subject of guns could trigger a media feeding frenzy. Witch hunts, investigations, search warrants, arrests, and so forth and so on, against both myself and the young man in question, since the Bill White legal precedent no longer demands that in order to arrest and imprison someone for many years for uttering or posting words that the dictatorship doesn't like, it's no longer necessary for any actual threat of any kind to be uttered against anyone. That's something I sure wish I could get some traction on. making all you folks out there understand that whole Bill White case and its implications for the future of our nation and our people. The Bill White case is the beginning of the judicial end of all constitutional freedom in this country, in ways which I've gone over before on this show, but I'd like to run over one quick aspect of that case again because it affects you guys directly. Bill White was originally convicted of publishing on the internet certain information which could have been located within 3 minutes by anyone who can use Google, and quicker than that by anyone who wanted to open a Pacer.gov account. What White published came from the transcript of a federal court case and was available online for those who knew where to look. For publishing this information on the internet, White received a crushing prison sentence. Seems to me it was 16 years or something like that, although he got so many of these imbecilic sentences in a row, now it's hard to keep track. Anyway, the Jewish judge who later rejected White's appeal ruled that Bill White, and Bill White alone, did not have any right to publish information from a publicly available legal document because, now get this, he was doing so for the benefit of a quote-unquote inherently criminal and violent audience. That audience being so-called white supremacists, and I still don't know exactly what the hell the dictator's servants mean by that, or how they define or understand that term, or if they even care. That's you, guys. In the eyes of the law, you are a quote-unquote inherently criminal and violent audience. All 6,000 or so of you per week. Every single one of you. And therefore, I do not have the right to speak about certain things on here or allow others to speak about them. That's what the courts have ruled anyway. There is no hard and fast guide to this fascinating new branch of criminal law that the Jewish judge seems to have just pulled out of his ass from somewhere as to exactly what does constitute an inherently criminal and violent audience, or what I can or cannot say to such an audience, but I'll bet you dollars for donuts that the FBI or some ambitious U.S. attorney here in Seattle would consider you guys such an audience, all 5,000 or 6,000 of you, and decide that while the Second Amendment may guarantee myself and the young man in question the right to keep and bear arms, the First Amendment does not allow us the right to talk about arms. Yes, it has gotten that raving mad in Obama's America.
Westbound and down, 18-wheels are rolling. Are we going to do what they say can be done? We've got a long way to go, and a short time to get there. I'm westbound just like a bandit run. If you put hard on the pedal, some never mind them brakes. Let it all hang out, cause we got to run to make.
Greetings, comrades. This is the trucker coming at you from Wyoming on a load going from Minnesota down to Southern California. And I wanted to touch base again about your migration. I've been passing a lot of people migrating, but not to the homeland. They're making their annual pilgrimage to a little known place called Sturgis. Yeah, I've been passed by hundreds, if not thousands, of motorcyclists in the past few days because I just did a delivery in St. Paul yesterday on the 31st, and so I came through the Black Hills area on Thursday, and yeah, there was oodles and oodles of motorcyclists heading to Sturgis. And then coming back through there this morning, even in the wee hours of the morning, 1, 2, 3 o'clock in the morning, are just basically almost an endless line of either motorcycles being ridden or trucked or trailered in. But yeah, all these people seem to be able to make their migration to Sturgis yearly. Either they save up for it, or they go and put themselves in debt to go and do it. But what, for a few days to a week worth of pleasure riding around the Black Hills? Yeah, I've got a motorcycle too, so yeah, I know what you, for all you bikers out there that like putting it in the wind and all that, but y'all put that much effort into some enjoyment rather than your security in your future out here in the homeland. I mean, we've got things you can go and do out here in the homeland. You don't even have to leave it once you get out here. The same weekend that this is going on, there's Seafair weekend there in the Seattle area. We got the hydroplane races. They got the Blue Angels that come in. You've got up there in Silverdale. They've got Whaling Days. Bremerton has got the Blackberry Festival. I forget what the deal up there in Poulsbo that they have annually, but yeah, you know, there's stuff going on all over the place out here in the homeland. If you go and get your ducks in a row, get your assets in gear, and get your asses out here, you could partake in this kind of stuff. But you'd rather go and head to Sturgis every year, get shit-faced, ride around on the motorcycles, and all that, oogle all the bikes that are there, maybe get into a few bar fights or street fights or whatever, and then go back home, like to Chicago, where 50 people were shot and killed last weekend. You've got to be kidding me. I mean, I heard about this. They've been covering it on one of the gun podcasts I listen to. It's one of those, you people just blow it off. And they've got the thing going on about this lion getting killed, and that's all you hear about on the news, on the Facebook and all that. But you don't hear about 50 people. Yeah, maybe they were gang members. Hey, no great loss there, but still, 50 people lost their lives. Or maybe it was primates, who knows. But anyway, 50 lives were ended in Chicago, and you don't hear jack about it on the regular news. So y'all just go and stay there, out there, while they go and wage war amongst themselves. And maybe you'll get killed in the crossfire and never make it to the homeland. Think about that. All right, well, this is a trucker enjoying some beautiful scenery coming across Wyoming. I know it's only a part of the fictional homeland, but come on. Let's get it together, follow the Butler plan, and listen to us that are out here already. Mr. Covington, Andy, and the rest of them. Stefan and Annie, got to meet them a couple of weekends ago. Yeah, and we've got other comrades that have already made their pilgrimage out here. Saw it on email. A few others have come out here, haven't met them yet. But, hey, they can figure out how to get out here. Why not you? All right, this is the trucker signing off from Wyoming. Have a good one, and we hope to see you out here in the homeland soon.
Okay, we have a comrade out there who would really love for our musical selections to be nothing but German marches from the Third Reich, which I admit I don't usually like to play because these recordings are 80 years old, and it's not because I don't appreciate the historical value, but they're tinny and scratchy and mono and do not in any way portray the true glory either of the music or of the time. I prefer much more modern recordings of German stuff like that Ich hatte einen Kameraden, I played for Ed Steele a while back, but I have to admit, this one's pretty good. It's called Westerwald.
Heute wollen wir marschieren, einen neuen Marsch holen, in dem schönen Westerwald, da dabei. In den schönen Westerwald, da pfeift der Wind so kalt.
evening, comrades, and welcome to my third installment of Arthur Kemp's March of the Titans. Now, first of all, I'm going to say a few words about Wales, and then I really have to move on. Wales is one of the very few, if any, locations where you can still see the old European Mediterranean type. And Wales has always been a distinct location in the British Isles. In the late 13th century, they fought for their independence, but they ended up being absorbed into the crown after 1536, a few years after Edward I was given the title Prince of Wales. Now, they also have an excellent section on the Irish and some of the issues that led to the Troubles. They talk about the Poynings Law, that the Irish had to get English approval for legislation, and also the Penal Law of 1665 that destroyed Irish commerce. So that led to the United Irish Society in 1798 and also the Catholic Association in 1823. And you also have the Tithe Wars, where the tithe tax was linked to rent charges. Now, all of this leads to Home Rule in 1923. And yes, there were still issues after that as well, but I've talked about that in other book reviews. So what I'd really like to move on to at this point is Eastern Europe, because if you want to talk about real race war, that's really where you can find it. Now, in Ukraine, in the year 965, you have Sviatoslav, who defeats the Khazars and the Bulgar Huns and saves Kiev. Also, in the year 955, the Saxons defeated the Magyars. Now, we also have this issue of Genghis Khan. He dies in 1227, but his son attacks Kiev in 1240. By the next year, you have Duke Henry II of Silesia, who was fighting the Huns. He was beheaded. And then you have King Wenceslav I of Bohemia, who was begging for help. And he could only get the Knights Templar and the Hospitallers. In 1240, Poland was also invaded. The Huns were also about to head to Vienna. Now, at this point, they learn of the death of their commander, and they lost the will to fight. Shortly after this, Vladislav unites Poland, and then Vladislav III would end up dying fighting the Turks. Now, in 1466, Poland actually annexes Prussia. And you also have Jan Sobieski III, who led a cavalry charge along with Austrians and Germans and breaks the Ottoman line, again saving Vienna, which always seems to be a target for these Huns. Now, another country that fought hard against the Ottomans was Romania. In 1456, you have Vlad Dracula, who was forced to give male children over to the Turks. And Vlad ends up fighting a guerrilla war against the Turks and becomes known as Vlad the Impaler. And that's where you get these stories of Dracula. Eventually, Vlad ends up being killed by a Turk. Not so surprisingly, because it's certainly understandable that the Turks would be after him. Much of Romania was later liberated under Michael the Brave, and then also King Stephen the Great finishes off that task. Another Balkan country that was very much devastated by the Ottomans was Albania. In 1506, Albania was almost completely overcome by the Turks, and many Albanians moved to other Slavic countries or escaped to the far south of Albania. In Bulgaria, you also have George Castrati, who ends up resisting the Ottomans for 25 years, but his resistance is overcome in 1506. Getting back to Poland, after the high point of 1466, Poles get involved in something called the War of Polish Secession. This leads to the partition of Poland by various European powers, and Poland is really under the auspices of other European countries for 125 years. Some Poles actually went to the Americas and they fought in the American Revolution and they tried to apply the fighting skills they had learned to the situation in Poland. But until Napoleon comes along, nothing really seems to help. Now, the Poles end up fighting for Napoleon, and by doing this, they regain much of Poland. Even after Napoleon was defeated, they get to keep some of the territories they've gained. Because Poland was still very much partitioned, in 1914, the Poles end up fighting on both sides. They get Danzig and they get some Czech territory. The Baltic countries were often under the influence of other nearby powers, although at one point Lithuania had an empire from the Baltic to the Black Sea. Now, in 1918, the Baltic countries declared independence, and in 1941, they were invaded by Russia. Because of this, because of the fact that most Balts were opposed to communism, many of the Balts volunteered for the SS. In the Balkans, during World War II, you do have shifting alliances, and that's because Balkans, unlike the Baltic region, Balkans are very diverse. Both Romania and Bulgaria ends up switching sides in World War II. They start off with the Axis, and then in 1944, they jump ship. In the case of Bulgaria, understand its sympathy for Germany in the sense that after World War I, it was very much in Germany's shoes. Actually, in 1878, it had actually become partially autonomous from the Ottoman Turks. What happens in the 1800s is the Ottoman power begins to wane. And actually, the Ottomans end up being called the sick man of Europe. If you've ever heard that phrase, that's where it comes from. However, the Ottomans did not go out without destroying the Armenians. And today, the once Indo-European nature of this group is but a remnant. Eventually, in 1941, Kosovo was given back to Albania, until it was taken by the Serbs. Now also, Greece gains independence in the year 1830, but obviously after so much time under Turkish rule, there's probably going to be some genetic consequence to that. The other consequence that we perhaps don't even realize these days is that the Stans out in the far eastern region beyond Russia, there used to be, or there still are, these countries called the Stans. And they really used to be much whiter. But after centuries of various Eastern invasions, they're also much less white. So what I wanted to emphasize in this review is that really, even though we don't always talk about it enough, the role of Eastern Europe in all of this turmoil and how that's always been something of a frontier within Europe and the influx of various peoples and various race wars that have gone on. So I thank you very much for listening. And I know that this book is one that takes a lot of time to actually read through. So I thank you for your patience, and I'll be doing reviews on this book until I'm finished. And I'm sure it's going to have a lot of valuable insights. So, have a good evening and hail victory, comrades.
On August the 6th, we had an RFN call-in show here in the homeland, and we got exactly one caller, Richard from Florida, and so Don and I spent about an hour and a half talking with Richard. We had a nice chit-chat, but basically you can't call a show with one caller a call-in show, and so I will be splitting the show up into several smaller segments and playing it on RFN over the next few weeks, kind of like I did with that one Mike Harris show a while back. Now that's a good way to save me some time every week, and also to let all you HAC fanatics out there get your weekly Herald ration. Now, on the call-in show, I know it's the middle of summer, and everything slacks off in the summer. One would hope because many of you have something else to do, outdoors, rather than sit around in front of your computers all night. However, one call is pathetic. Now, I sent the notice on that show out twice, the first time 48 hours before to the Northwest Revolution list, and that's a lot of people. I won't say how many on the air. Now, I don't know what happened last Thursday. My guess is it's a case of a lot of you are simply tired of getting all these emails from old Harold. You figure that's just Harold babbling to himself again, nothing important, and so you sloughed it off and simply didn't read either of those messages, clearly marked call-in show Thursday, August 6th. Now, I have, over the past several weeks, gotten some complaints from some of you hollering, "Harold, Harold, why didn't you tell me there was a call-in show? Why didn't you send me the Skype number? I wanted the call, but you never send me the number." Okay, at first I figured this was a problem because somehow some of the email addresses didn't survive the jump between computers when my Ancient Mariner died several weeks ago. And it's true, Scotty seems to have beamed certain addresses that were on the Northwest Revolution list up to the Enterprise. I am still reconstructing the list, although it could use a good purge anyway due to months of non-response on the part of a lot of you, and this is probably a good opportunity. However, when I get these complaints from people alleging I never sent the number for the call-in show to them, I look over the list I'm using, and sure enough, there you are. So yes, I sent you both notices for last week's show, and either you didn't read the emails, or somehow they ended up in your spam folder. I don't know what to tell you guys other than check your spam folder. If you've been receiving Northwest Revolution emails, but not recently because all of a sudden they stopped a few weeks ago, let me know and I will restore you to the list. Like I said, for some reason I haven't figured out, certain email addresses did, in fact, do a Houdini act during the transition. Anyway, that's why you're going to be getting bits and pieces of the August 6th call-in show over the next 6 weeks or so. But before we start, here's a little Tchaikovsky, just for the hell of it. This is the Radio Free Northwest call show. We're speaking to you from the Northwest homeland, and the date is August the 6th, 2015. One of our guys suggested that we talk about Andrew Anglin of the Daily Stormer website and that problem he's having with the reporter who outed his mother.
I don't know how many of our listeners are familiar with the Daily Stormer website, but it's run by a guy named Andrew Anglin. And back about a month ago, when all the foo-for-all was happening about that kid in Charleston, it appears that young Dylan Roof, in addition to looking at our website and rejecting the Northwest message, also read and apparently posted on Anglin's Daily Stormer website, and somehow read that the media tracked this down. And the long and the short of it is, a reporter rocked up on the doorstep of Andrew Anglin's mother, and she basically refused to have anything to do with him, and so either in retaliation or just out of policy of giving our people as much trouble as possible, this guy, who was a reporter for the local NBC affiliate, a television station presumably, proceeded to display to his viewers Mr. Anglin's mother's home while he made his little snide commentary. I don't know, I didn't see the actual clip, but it was something like that, and I'm sufficiently familiar with the practices of these media people to understand what happened. And apparently, she started getting all kinds of harassment and threats and vandalism and all that good mess, and she's now having to more or less flee her home. And it got Mr. Anglin very righteously pissed off, I would say. So he has started a campaign of making his displeasure felt to this reporter, whom I will not name in view of the Bill White precedent and in view of the inherently criminal and violent nature of all you guys out there. But I think this is just a good example of the type of behavior that we can expect from the liberal media, more so from now on, although they used to do it back in the day as well. Any reporter with two brain cells is going to be aware of the effect of displaying the home of a member of a persecuted minority to viewers who are likely to commit assorted bad acts, which in America is most of them. A lot of them will do it because of ideological means. They'll harass somebody or threaten them or throw rocks to their windows and that sort of stuff, throw paint all over their doorstep, etc. They'll do it out of left-wing or liberal or Democratic Party ideological motivations. But also the simple fact is that we live in a society where there's a lot of nuts. And any time that nutty element gets the idea that here's somebody they can victimize with impunity, as they can anyone connected with white nationalism in any way, they're going to do so. And the reporter in question had to be aware of this. I don't think there can be any doubt that this was done deliberately, purely to attack Andrew Anglin and his website. And although I'm not too sanguine about Mr. Anglin's chances of actually effecting any change in the station's policy or getting the reporter fired, which is what he says he wants to do, still, I think it's a timely reminder of what can happen in our wonderful world of social media and instant electronic communication and blah, blah, blah. Tonight, there is the Republican primary presidential debate, the first one. Apparently, there are 17 candidates in the Republican field, and I have no idea of who they are other than maybe half of them. And the big thing right now is what they're going to do with Donald Trump, because he is leading in the polls, making it virtually impossible for them to exclude him from the debates, which is what I'm sure everybody wanted to do. And according to various media articles I'm reading in the left-wing blogosphere and whatnot this morning, the donor class in the Republican Party have given their marching orders to people like Marco Rubio and Jeb Bush and Ted Cruz. Tonight you have to take out Trump. We're tired of this horrible embarrassment of this guy saying things that shouldn't be said and making us all look bad and so forth and so on. So apparently there is this conspiracy going on between the so-called mainstream candidates and Fox News. They're going to try and do something to embarrass Trump or throw him off his stride or trick him or anger him into saying something really bad, maybe, you know, saying nigger in public or something like that. That's going on actually right now as we speak, I think, so.
Well, from what I've been reading, the tactics they've used so far have backfired. Whenever they try to smear Trump and try to do exactly what you said, force him to say something that's so controversial that they expect him to lose support, the opposite happens. Yeah. He gains support.
I think what people mainly admire about him is that even when he does say something a bit outrageous in the establishment sense of the word, he just doesn't backtrack. He just says, look, this is my opinion. I don't particularly think John McCain is bee's knees. I don't care who knows it. No, I'm not going to apologize. I'm not going to walk it back. I'm not going to do anything. You know, I am no longer going to condition my public utterances to politically correct ideology or whatever you want to call this little bit of totalitarian mind control that we live in. And I think that's actually getting him almost as many points as what he's actually saying. And of course, what he's actually saying is things that the majority of the normal, real people in this country agree with. Also, apparently, he's branching out now from just the immigration issue He's either presented or he is putting together a formal flat tax proposal, which will more or less simplify revenue collection in this country immensely, and it will also largely take the wind out of the sails of the Internal Revenue Service, which is something that very badly needs to be done. The Internal Revenue Service is clearly completely out of control. This Jewish woman, Lois Lerner, has basically told the Congress and several courts and everyone else to just go commit an unnatural act with themselves. She is not going to produce any of her emails. She has clearly destroyed them. Apparently, they found her hard drive and it was physically damaged. Somebody taking a hammer to it or something. So the IRS as a whole definitely needs to be taken down a peg or two. I don't think there can be any question that the IRS is being and has been, probably still is, being used as a weapon against the Tea Party and other domestic political opponents of the Obama regime. So the fact is, buffoon or not, Trump, in what he has said publicly so far, is right on the money, and everybody knows it, everybody approves, and I'll be really interested to see what they try and do to mess him up tonight. And I'll be interested to see if he can escape from the trap, so to speak. And he's not a fool. He will have had plenty of advance warning that they're trying to trap him at this debate, so should be interesting. I will say something that I said in my notice email for this call-in show. We're going to restrict it to 90 minutes tonight because the last time I did a call-in show, I actually had to cut out some content. I had to cut out most of one of the callers from Florida, etc., because we need to bring these call-in shows down below an hour and 20 minutes. You're on Radio Free Northwest. Who am I speaking with, please?
This is Richard from Florida.
All right, Richard. Were you the gentleman that I kind of had to cut out last time because I had to get it below an hour and 20 minutes? I can't remember. It was one of the guys from Florida.
It might have been, but I don't recall, to tell you the truth. I did listen to the cast after you had edited it, but I didn't notice what was missing.
Richard, I recall, and it was you.
Well, I'd like to apologize. I was just explaining to the listeners that, as I said in my notice email, we're going to have to cut this to like 90 minutes tonight because I have to see if I can cut out filler and whatnot to bring the finished product down below an hour and 20 minutes so that I can make copies of the podcast on CDs, because we do have a lot of people who don't have computers or who, for various reasons, actually prefer to listen to Radio Free Northwest on CDs.
Well, no offense taken. You're taking a lot of material, and you have to make it fit into your agenda for the program, so I don't mind at all.
Just before you called, we were talking about the presidential debates, which I believe are beginning even as we speak right now. It's 5:11 out here on the Pacific Coast.
They're going to start here at 9 o'clock.
And it looks like they're going to try and trap Donald Trump into doing something that will embarrass him or trip him up or get him to say a forbidden word on the air or something like that.
Yeah, I feel this political theater would be interesting to watch. I'm sure they're going to try and get him under control. But then again, as I said before in the earlier program, I don't know how much of this is real, even whether Donald Trump is real, because we don't have all the facts. I hope he is really bucking the system, but time will tell. I think the key to this, or not the key to it, but a hint at it, is the 2008 election with Ron Paul. Ron Paul was the only one that had a decent message up there, and I was enthralled. I said, great, we're going to get, finally, somebody's going to do something. And Ron Paul went all the way through, and then they cheated him in the primaries in New Hampshire and Iowa, and nothing was done. Yeah, he didn't do anything. He had a little leeway to say some things, but if he's going to really do anything, I think he kept quiet. And, of course, the coup de grace was his son. When his son voted Mitt Romney, and then later on, and this was really bizarre in my opinion, we saw pictures of Rand Paul in Israel with his yarmulke on and his son next to him, and here he is doing the bippity-bop on the Wailing Wall. You can tell he was either controlled from the beginning or they got him under control. So that's what I'm thinking about Trump, maybe.
Well, Rush Limbaugh made an interesting comment this morning. There was some rumor floating around that before Trump announced his candidacy, he was doing some phone conversation with Bill Clinton, and the latest conspiracy theory is that Bill Clinton persuaded or tried to talk Trump into running for president specifically to create eventually a third-party effort similar to what happened with Ross Perot in 1992, which of course is how the Clintons won in 1992, and they're in essence trying to make Donald Trump the next Ross Perot, because if they do basically Jew Trump out of the nomination, which if he keeps it up, they will do. I don't think he's going to get nominated because the Republican Party establishment simply won't allow it. And so he's going to get all mad and butthurt and saying, well, damn it, I'm going to run as a third-party candidate, which, of course, will leech away white votes from the Republicans and let Hillary just stroll right in, which I have to admit there is a certain Machiavellian sense about that. I don't know if Trump would fall for it. I don't think he's as stupid as he lets on, and also I imagine that a lot of his loudmouth buffoon image has to do not so much with him himself, but with the media. But it's something to consider.
Also, I think I listened to that same portion of Rush Limbaugh's talk today, and it's kind of ambiguous who called who. Some news outlets are reporting that Trump called Clinton, and then they're saying that Clinton called Trump. I think Rush Limbaugh said it's probably a PSYOP operation.
Well, it could be. I'm, as I've made clear before, kind of ambiguous on the whole conspiracy theory thing, because, number one, yes, there are conspiracies. Number two, yeah, sometimes these things turn out to be true, but on the other hand, I think if we have this attitude that the little men behind the curtain are just controlling everything and pulling all the strings, they know all, they are omnipotent and omniscient, etc., then that leads us into the attitude of, oh, there's just no point in trying to do anything, it's all hopeless, we're all controlled, etc. So sometimes things just happen. I think our ruling elite right now in this country suffers from a kind of an occupational disease of most ruling elites. How can I put this? They habitually overestimate their ability to control events. Sometimes events really do slip out of control. And it could be that Trump is just a genuine wild card. It could be that this is one of these cases where a cigar really is just a cigar, and it's exactly what it looks like, and he's just this wealthy man who has decided he would like to add President of the United States to his resume, and he's figured out that the way to do that, or at least have a good chance to do that, is to actually reinvent himself as the spokesman for the dispossessed majority in this country. So, well, we'll have to see how it plays out.
Yeah, with the deceit and lies, they certainly left a big void for somebody to jump in. You know, this conspiracy theory thing is one of those control words I think they use. Conspiracy just means people are working together for whatever their agenda is. Something shameful or idiotic. So you got five guys over there and they want to push their agenda. And if they don't tell anybody, well, so what? But it's not to be ashamed of if you spot it.
I think Bismarck once said that the mark of a true liberal is an inability to believe in conspiracies.
One way or another, I'm gonna find you. I'm gonna get you.
how's life down there in Florida? Still hot and muggy?
Well, yeah, it's hot, but I'll give you a little more information. We have, I've learned this week, we have 7 sanctuary cities here in Florida. And I don't know them all, but it's probably all the big ones, you know, Tampa, Miami, Orlando.
Yeah. One of the things noticed is there seems to be a mood of rebellion across the country on both sides of the political spectrum.
I think a lot of Democrats, even of the more traditional variety, are starting to realize that basically their party has made a dog's dinner of everything. Even the liberals, although they won't admit it in public, are starting to get a little bit worried about what's going to happen. I am convinced that there is a very, very strong and influential section of the Democratic Party that does not want anything to do with a Hillary Clinton presidency. And I don't blame them, because when you think about the way she's been behaving just in the past year or so, can you imagine if this decrepit and apparently confused woman ever actually were able to get hold of the reins of power? Oh, my God. Not just that, but she's got a whole lifetime of vengeance to wreak on the various people she thinks have done her wrong, which is basically probably anybody white and male, maybe even her own husband. Maybe she just wants to get back in the White House so she can make a big show of locking Bill out.
Quite a despicable character. I can't believe that people take her serious. She's not a serious candidate. They make her a serious candidate, but if you've got any kind of political acumen and you're at least decently moral, how could that woman be your president?
But because the people of this country very largely have lost any sense of decency and morality. Part of it's cynicism, I think. They just literally don't expect anything more out of politicians. But part of it is just the erosion of any kind of moral compass in everybody. That's what the media have spent and Hollywood have spent 3 generations doing.
Oh, yeah. You hit a very good point there. I think it's gotten so bad that they really don't expect honesty out of the politician. I mean, they'd love to have it, but as long as he's got the credentials and his face gets on TV, he's a viable candidate. They've lost their way. The public's lost their way. You're right. They don't have any standards. Their standards, I think, are shifted and pushed around by what they can get for free, what makes them feel good.
As I was saying earlier, there are apparently now 17 candidates in the Republican field. I can name maybe 8 or 9 of them. I noticed that they let that monkoid Ben Carson in because I think they didn't dare not let him in. Also, they, I suppose, wanted a black face up there when they ran the little photo fit with all the 10 candidates. The Republicans have some weird ideas. Somehow or other, they think that they are going to get blacks to vote for them. And above all, they are convinced that somehow or other, they are going to persuade the Beaners to vote for them. Never mind the fact that these millions that Obama is bringing in right now are among the poorest and scummiest of the lot, and they are clearly being brought in as bulk Democrat voters. And they come from countries where this kind of thing is just completely understood. The government is totally corrupt. And I'm sure these people that are crossing the border right now fully understand the quid pro quo. They get their green card, and they get their EBT card, and they get their flat-screen TV and their Obama phone, and they get to basically around all day in L.A. or Houston or Miami or someplace and be part of the 95 million unemployed. And in exchange, every election day, they walk into the polling booth and they pull the lever with D on it. This idea that somehow or other Republicans are going to get minority votes is ridiculous. If they had any political savvy, never mind any real love of the country, they would do exactly what they're accused of doing by the left-wing bloggers, and that is position themselves as the party of the white majority. And we are still a majority. I know it's sometimes hard to remember, but we are.
I had a thought when Trump said that they're not sending us their best. I thought, I wonder if the Beaners had got across the border and they're established in whatever occupation they've got, but they're making their way. I wonder if they feel threatened by more immigration.
Oh, definitely. Their job is definitely. That's something that's been talked about a lot. And the ones you're talking about, particularly the ones who came across the border legally, they're established, they identify with the United States, and they see these illegal invaders from Mexico and other parts of Central America as competition and as a threat.
They're also resentful as hell. They came here legally. They went through all the incredible vast bureaucracy of the INS and whatnot. They took their little test on American history, and they jumped through all the hoops, and it took years and years. And they, I'm sure, really resent these wetbacks just strolling across the Rio Grande and automatically getting everything handed to them on a silver platter that they had to work for. So I imagine that's a lot of it.
Another thing that I heard Trump say that interested me was, I caught an interview with some newscaster, and he was talking about Ford building a $2.5 billion plant in Mexico. And Trump's solution would be, he said if he was president, would be call up the CEO and congratulate him on the plant and said, oh, by the way, it's going to be a 35% tariff on all cars coming into the United States or Mexico, which I thought was a good line. Coupled with that, I picked up something on China and this Trans-Pacific Partnership deal. And it's kind of like not widely known, I guess, and I hope what I saw was true so I can believe in it, that China is so heavy into robotics that workers are going to be displaced, and they're already being displaced, but it's going to get even worse. And I wonder if that $2.5 billion plant in Mexico, where the robotics are going to play a part in that, and maybe the Mexicans won't get as many jobs out of this as they think. So I don't know, it's destroying the labor base. They're eliminating jobs through automation and robotics. I wonder how that's going to play into things. Of course, we don't see it now because it hasn't happened in totality.
Well, I agree with you, and I have a comment about that. It's nothing new, first of all, and it's already had a huge impact in the United States historically. They've been around for decades now, these robots. They're just getting more and more sophisticated, and they're doing jobs that require more and more intelligence, education, skill, these sorts of things. And in fact, they're displacing jobs that used to be considered very skilled jobs or even white-collar jobs. The ultimate impact of this, honestly, is going to be that damn few people are going to be necessary to produce the goods and services that society consumes. And as this happens, we're going to have larger and larger percentage systemic unemployment. And it's something that society is going to have to grapple with. An all-white society will have to grapple with it. A mixed-race society or a non-white society is going to be faced with the same problem. And what's the answer? It appears to me that ultimately everyone will have some kind of either government-issued or more generally socially understood claim on the goods and services produced by this robotic artificial intelligence-based production system. This includes things like robotic surgery and other things that are very highly skilled jobs that are being automated.
You ever heard of something called UBI? I've been seeing some more and more passing mentions of this in the lefty blogs. UBI is Universal Basic Income, and some left-wing economist came up with this some time ago. But the idea is just to say, what the hell, put everybody on welfare. When you turn 16 or 18, you start automatically getting a universal basic income check from the government. And that way everyone has their basic subsistence allowance of money, and no one really has to work in the sense of if they don't, they'll end up under a bridge. And therefore, we have this wonderful free society, and everybody can just do what they want, and la-di-da-di-da-di-da. Now, even I can see that it just wouldn't work. Money and wealth and whatnot has to come from somewhere. It cannot simply be forever created on computer databases. At some point in time, your economy has to have some connection with what's going on in the real world, but that is one of the things that we're starting to see resurfacing on places like Salon. And I tell people, read Salon magazine, because as weird as some of that stuff is, the stuff that you see on Salon right now is going to be government policy in 10 years. I started reading it about 10 years ago, and I can tell you that's true.
Well, our time is up for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington 98194, or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Andaban. Freedom.
Still is beating heart.